Welcome to the NewsHour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Rich Wiles. Rich is a UK-based author and photographic artist. He spent most of the past 5 years in occupied Palestine documenting events there. And there are always important things going on in occupied Palestine. I write more about that than any other single topic, and I write about many topics. Rich is also Assistant Project Coordinator of Our Voice, Refugee Youth Magazine. The website is refugeevoice.org. It's an arts and media project being implemented in 6 West Bank refugee camps. Since 2005, Rich lived in the, I believe it's pronounced Aida refugee camp. It's spelled A-I-D-D-A. Opera lovers will pronounce it Aida. But the composer was Italian, and we're talking about Palestine. I'll let Rich correct my pronunciation if I have it wrong. He was running art projects for the residents as a form of resistance, communication, and self-expression. Rich has a new book about his experience, his own comments, and stories, vignettes from the people who live there and what their lives are like. It's titled Occupied Palestine. I'm sorry. It's titled Behind the Wall, Life, Love, and Struggle in Palestine. It's a daily struggle. It hasn't ended in over 60 years. Don't see any light at the end of the tunnel yet. Rich, I welcome you to the program.
Thank you, Stephen.
I'm delighted to talk about Occupied Palestine anytime because it absolutely is at the top of the list of importance for me. It's certainly solving that problem, which would be very simple if Israel were a normal state. It is not. The same goes for America. It's worse. If both those states were what they claim to be, which they're not, we could solve this problem overnight, maybe in an afternoon, maybe in an hour, maybe in 5 minutes. Because the Palestinians don't ask for much, as you know, Rich. They just want to be free people like everybody else. They don't want to fight wars with anybody.
Of course,
they want to live
Palestinians
free.
Are just looking for justice, looking to live
they
with
want justice,
rights,
exactly.
With human rights, with justice.
Rich, one more comment, then you jump in. We have a few commercial breaks, one in about a minute. You probably know the history. I know it well enough to know that when things were a lot different in the early part of the last century, when the Arab population greatly outnumbered the Jewish population, there was no strife. People lived together in the same neighborhoods. They got along with each other. They didn't shoot each other. They didn't imprison each other. They didn't put up roadblocks. They weren't under military occupation, the Arabs being the occupier. It was exactly the opposite. I don't know that things were 100% perfect. Are they anyplace? But people lived like normal people, and they got along with each other. But once Israel became Israel, that changed. Rich, you begin, and momentarily we're going to hear some music. And then I'll break in and you can pick it up again. Talk about your book and your experience. Is it the Aida refugee camp?
Aida. We pronounce it Aida camp.
Aida, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Oh, there's that music. Let's take that break and then you take over when we come back.
Okay, thank you.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Rich's book again is called Behind the Wall, Life, Love, and Struggle in Palestine. And one comment, Rich, before I let you talk about the book and your experience spending so much, 5 years or so, in the Aida refugee camp doing the wonderful work you were doing. We'll end the program at 10 minutes to the hour. As I mentioned to you in an email, I hope you spotted this morning. so I can make an important announcement. But talk about your experiences there and your book.
Well, I first went to Palestine in 2003 as a photographer. Really, as somebody, I think as most people are, tending to believe that I had some understanding of what was happening in Palestine. What I learned during the first trip was only a short trip. It was about 2.5 weeks. And what I found in those 2.5 weeks was that I think I had very little understanding of what the reality, what was really happening on the ground in Palestine. Whatever we see through the media, through the televisions, through reading books, we're never going to be really prepared for the reality that is life under occupation in Palestine. In 2005, I first visited Aida refugee camp. Before then, I'd been living in the cities of Bethlehem and Al-Khalil, Hebron. I'd lived in both of those cities on and off for the early time that I was in Palestine. And in 2005, I first visited Aida refugee camp. And I was very interested in finding ways to work with young people in Palestine to help them, to assist them in being able to tell their own stories through art to the wider world, which is why where my relationship with Aida refugee camp really first came from. So I began to run photography projects with a centre called Large E Centre, which is a creative, cultural, children's and youth centre in Aida refugee camp, which does a lot of work with different kinds of creative projects. We use film, we use photography, we use literature, different forms of new media, as forms of self-expression and as forms of resistance. And as ways for the young people of the camp, the new generations of Palestinian refugees, to be able to tell their stories to the wider world. And what I found in those days when I first visited Aida camp, I was living in a house in the city of Bethlehem, no more than 10-15 minutes walk from Aida camp. But I found a very different environment inside the camp to the situation that I was living in outside of the camp. I could live in the area of Bethlehem that I lived in was a relatively comfortable middle class sort of area. And to walk from there into Aida refugee camp, which as they say was no more than a 10-minute walk, yet within the first 2 or 3 minutes of entering the refugee camp, I would invariably hear the sound of shooting, which was the IOF, the Israeli Occupation Forces, raining bullets down onto Aida camp and its residents. And this wasn't happening a kilometre, half a kilometre away where I was living, just on the other side of Bethlehem. Of course, the occupation armies still were attacking Bethlehem, were still invading Bethlehem, but the attacks inside the camp were a lot more frequent. They were at that stage in 2005, it was literally every single day when the occupation forces would be inside the camp and would spend hours every day just basically shooting at children, children and young people of the camp. And I found this a very, you know, in such a short distance from the house that I was living at, I found a very kind of different world, if you like, inside the refugee camp. And eventually, within a month or two of beginning work in Aida camp, I'd moved to live inside the camp itself because I found it was such a different environment. And I didn't think it wasn't working for me to be living outside of the camp away from the really intense kind of situation that people were forced to live under. And then going back to the camp on a daytime, often at that stage during the evenings, during the night times, is when the camp would often get invaded heavily. There'd be shooting. People's houses would get smashed up, broken into, attacked by the occupation forces. And I felt that I had to be inside the camp all the time, living with people all the time, to really show on one level that I was really truly with them and standing with people in the camp and supporting people in the camp. And on another level, for me to be able to really understand what it meant to live inside a refugee camp, I needed to be there all the time with people living inside the camp and there all the time, really. So I moved into the camp and I've been in the camp on, you know, pretty much ever since. And I started writing probably a year or so after I'd moved to live inside Aida camp. I was taking photographs, I was working with children inside the camp, I was involved in many different sorts of projects. And it was probably a little bit earlier than that. One day, it was just before I moved into the camp, I was walking into the camp one morning, and I walked alongside a huge empty building, which was very close to the Rachel's Tomb compound, which is the Israeli military base in Bethlehem. And as I walked past the building, everything seemed very quiet. It was maybe 9:30 in the morning, and I walked straight past the building and went for a little walk inside the camp. The Largy Centre wasn't open yet that morning, so I just went for a little walk around the camp just to kill some time, really. And on the road at the top of the camp, I found a United Nations vehicle, a Jeep, and inside were some of the United Nations workers, internationals. They were not Palestinians, but were working for the United Nations. And the United Nations building in Ida Camp is actually alongside this very large empty building that I'd walked past when I walked into the camp. So I couldn't understand why the UN workers were parked a long way away from this building at the top of the camp. So I went to speak to them and just asked them how they were, are they okay, is there anything I could do to help? And they said they were not allowed to drive down into the camp yet because the Israeli army have occupied one of the buildings next to our office. And I hadn't noticed anything when I walked into the camp. So I said, you know, I asked them, are you sure about this? I said, I just walked down this road and I've not noticed any soldiers or jeeps or anything. And they said to me, no, they've been in the large empty building that's right alongside the United Nations office. They've been in there since about 4 or 5 o'clock this morning. We believe they've taken some of the United Nations workers into that building as human shields. So the United Nations workers told me, and these were official United Nations workers, that they had to get clearance from the Israeli army to actually go to their building, and they had not been given this clearance, which is why they were parked further away inside the camp. So I walked back down towards the building to see what I could see, because everything had seemed very quiet. Usually when the soldiers are in the camp, you can see jeeps or you can hear shooting or some other sign that they're there. But there was nothing this morning. So I walked back down towards the building. And as I neared the building, a head popped out of one of the windows at the top and an M16 pointed at me. And I just saw a face of a young Israeli soldier. And he just pointed down at me and put his finger to his lips as if to say, shush, be quiet, don't tell anybody that we're here. And sure enough, as I looked around the other windows, I could see the barrels of M16s pointing out of all of the windows. And it was clear that the Israeli army had occupied this building during the night time. And as it transpired during the day, they had in fact taken some United Nations workers inside the building with them. And they were effectively using these people as human shields. And they stayed in this building until mid to late afternoon, maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So they'd been in there getting on for 12 hours in total. And just spent the entire day using the windows of this building to shoot into the camp, basically. One child was actually shot that day as he walked down carrying his garbage, his trash. He was trying to take that down to the United Nations skips, where the trash is collected. And he was actually shot in the stomach as he tried to take his garbage away, basically. And this was the first story that I ever wrote. In Ida Camp, basically, I really didn't know what to do. I went by, took some photographs. I went back to Largy Centre once the centre opened, and I just wrote a very quick email, which I sent out to as many people as I had on my email list, just to tell people what was happening. One of my frustrations at this point was that as the camp was getting attacked basically every day by the occupation forces, it was quite rare to actually see journalists inside the camp. It was such an everyday occurrence that even Palestinian journalists very rarely came to the camp to tell this story. International journalists were virtually non-existent in the camp in those days. I never saw international journalists. And every couple of weeks or so, a Palestinian journalist might come down if something really severe was happening. But basically, nobody was telling these stories. In the house that I lived at, less than 1 kilometre away in the city of Bethlehem, the people that lived alongside me there often found it hard to believe the stories that I was telling them about what was happening inside the camp. Because they could hear shooting somewhere in the distance, but shooting was a regular occurrence, and people didn't stop and listen, you know, and stop and think every time they heard shooting because it was so often. So people in the area where I was living found it very difficult to believe the stories that I was telling them because they hadn't seen people get shot. They weren't seeing houses get shot at. But this was an actual everyday occurrence inside the camp. And so I started to write. I started to want to tell people these stories. And from this first email that I sent explaining this situation that was happening inside the camp, I got a lot of responses to it. And that was really the beginnings of my writing about the everyday life, the occurrences, what it meant to be Palestinian refugee, living in a refugee camp, nearly at that stage, 60 years after Al-Nakba, after 700 to 750,000 to 800,000 people were forced from their homes during the Nakba. And some of these survivors are still living in either refugee camp, and then their children are there, and their grandchildren. In some cases now, we have the great-grandchildren, the fourth generation of refugees that are stuck inside this tiny refugee camp that is now surrounded by the apartheid wall. It's the only West Bank refugee camp that is surrounded by the apartheid wall. And there's everybody, after 60 years of this ongoing torture, this ongoing oppression that Palestinians have lived under for over 60 years now, everybody has stories to tell. Every single Palestinian from any age has got a story to tell. Everybody's got friends, brothers or sisters or relatives that are in prison. Everybody knows people that have been shot or that have been killed. For the refugees themselves, they're people that, as I said, we're now of the fourth generation of people that are being forced to live as refugees, that are being born as refugees. And some of these people living, some of the villages that the people in Aida camp were forced from during the Nakba, are no more than 5 or 10 kilometres from the camp. Excuse me.
Rich, we have to take... I'm sorry to interrupt. We need to break. Let's do that. Hold your thought, and then pick right up when we come back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back on with Rich Wiles. His book again, from his own experiences and the stories of people related in the book, is called Behind the Wall, Life, Love, and Struggle in Palestine. Rich, it really is shocking that for over 60 years, May 1948, Israel became a state. The conflict broke out before that. It was percolating for a good amount of time, and Israel's so-called War of Independence began in 1947. I was about 13 years old at the time. I can't remember Israel ever even being discussed in my household, in my home, by my parents growing up. Well, of course, for so many years, there was no Israel. And then 1948, Israel emerged. That war happened. The occupation of what's called Occupied Palestine today began after the 1967 Six-Day War. So Palestinians in 1948 lost roughly 78% of their homeland and retained in the occupied territories as of 1967, 22%. Well, they retain a lot less today because of Israel's settlement building in the West Bank. There were small settlements in Gaza. Israel got them out because they didn't want them in harm's way when they decided to attack Gaza, which they've done more than once. They did it over a year ago, so-called Operation Cast Lead, this massacre of civilians that Israel conducted, vicious war crimes. We've talked a lot about it on this program. But, Rich, as you know, you saw it. I've never been there. I've written so much about what goes on, covering so many different topics. But the one missing link for me is I've never been there to see it myself in the West Bank, let alone in Gaza under siege, especially after the mass destruction from over a year ago. But so it's impossible for listeners who haven't seen it, Rich, and impossible for me too, to imagine people living under occupation for all these decades and to have had their homeland stolen, and now an oppressive occupier runs their lives under military rule, not civil rule. In 1948, over 500 Palestinian villages were literally erased, bulldozed to rubble, and reemerged as Jewish communities, whatever, settlements. They're in the West Bank entirely. Roughly 500,000 Jews in West Bank settlements. I could go on and on, Rich, but you continue with your story. It's a horrific story. One more comment. It's also astonishing that over six decades later, people are still living in refugee camps. They sure are.
Of course, yes. You know, I mean, the idea of a refugee camp is something that's short-term and temporary. It's meant to be a short-term hosting place until refugees are given, you know, a return to their land or something happens to give them some kind of elements of justice. And the refugee camps in Palestine, people are often surprised when they visit Aida camp or any refugee camp in Palestine, because people often have this stereotypical view of a refugee camp, such as the camps we see in Sudan or Somalia, of people living in tents. And when they visit the refugee camps in such as Aida camp, they will see houses, some houses that people have put a lot of work into, that they've built themselves, that they've worked for many, many years since they've been refugees, to build themselves a house. And people are surprised that they see a standard of living that is not tents and the real desperation that you see in places like Sudan. But what I always say to people is that after 60 years, people are not going to stay in a tent for 60 years. People have to have some kind of standard of living. And this does not mean at any stage that people are giving up or moving away from their right to return. It simply means that people are not going to sit in a tent for 60 years. So the refugee camps in Palestine now, people living inside houses, there's electricity inside the camps. Water's still a huge, huge problem inside the camps today. To give you an example with Aida camp, since it's the place that I live, in Aida camp we get water on average once every 5 or 6 days, maybe once a week. And the water will be turned on for 2 or 3 hours to the camp. And during those 2 or 3 hours, the water will be turned on into the generator at the camp, and then it's pumped to people's houses. And in those 2 or 3 hours, people have to get as much water as they can onto the rooftop tanks. They have water tanks on top of the roofs because people don't have a constant supply of water. And this water then has to last people until the next time the water arrives, which during the winter might be 4 or 5 days. During the summer months, this can often stretch for weeks and weeks on end without any water at all inside people's houses. To give you an example of last summer, some people in some places on either camp went 10 weeks through the summer without getting any access to fresh water at all inside their houses. Now, this is a totally inhuman way for people to have to live. People will come back on the argument and say that the Middle East is a very dry part of the world, and this is true. It certainly doesn't have the rain that we have in England or in Europe. It's a much drier part of the world. But the apartheid wall that surrounds Aida camp, maybe 1 kilometre, the other side's one. You can see it from the top of the house inside the camp. You can see Gilo settlement, which is one of the, as you were talking about, the illegal colonies, the illegal settlement that Israel has built inside the West Bank. So this Gilo settlement is built inside the West Bank. It's on West Bank land. And Gilo has water 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So water to Jewish Israelis is there. It's being given to people, even though they're inside the West Bank.
We need to break again, Rich. We need to break again.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
His book, Behind the Wall, Life, Love, and Struggle in Palestine. Rich, I'll emphasize one thing. Oh, there are so many points to be made, and they are on other programs. International law, there are so many Palestinian refugees, not only in the camps, but the Palestinian diaspora, and international law that Israel agreed to and then abrogated absolutely guarantees the right of return. UN Resolution 194, it's got a lot of provisions. One in it is that all refugees wanting to return to their homes and being willing to live in peace and so on, those kinds of provisions, absolutely have the right to do so. And if, or otherwise, be duly compensated for the property that was lost. I mean, this is law, and Israel agreed to it. Universal Declaration of Human Rights says the same thing, much more briefly, that anybody has the right to leave their country any country, including his or her own, and return to his or her own country. That's a provision in the laws. Israel agreed to it, and Israel absolutely refuses to allow the right of return. And nobody does anything about it. But you continue.
Of course, the right of return is a fundamental, if not the kind of pivotal issue to the Palestinian question. As you say, all refugees, which includes the original refugees and their descendants, have, according to international law, such as United Nations Resolution 194, the full right to return to their land. And that is entirely what the refugees are still waiting for. This is, as we've said, this is well over 60 years now, but nobody's has given up this right. If I speak to even the youngest children in Ida Camp, I can ask them where they live, and they'll say they live in Ida Camp. If I ask them where they're from, they'll say Ajour or Beit Jibreen or Al Malha, or the name of the original village that their grandparents or possibly great-grandparents were forced out of during the Nakba years. And this is a fundamental issue, and it's also an issue that has never been addressed in any of the so-called peace process. Yet it's a fundamental issue to Palestinian rights and to human rights as well. It's something that must be upheld, that has been ratified several times since 1948, and that people are still waiting for this right and struggling for this right. And until the right of return, until this issue is addressed, the issue of the refugees, there's never going to be stability in that part of the world, and in much of the world, because we all understand the kind of knock-on effects that what's happening in the Middle East has on all parts of the world, really. So the right of return is a very fundamental issue. To the case for Palestine, the stories in my book are very much focused inside refugee camps, and I did this because there are many, many books written about Palestine, and there are many books written by internationals about their experiences in Palestine. The idea of my book, Behind the Wall, Life, Love and Struggle in Palestine, was really to provide a platform for Palestinians, specifically refugees, although not exclusively, to be able to tell their own stories. I often feel as I travel around the world giving exhibitions and talking about Palestine, the majority of people I hear talking about Palestine, including myself clearly, are non-Palestinian. And I think it's very important to open up avenues for Palestinians to communicate directly and to tell their own stories, as nobody can understand what occupation, what colonisation, what apartheid means in the way that a Palestinian himself who's living under that regime can understand. So the stories in my book are really a collection, beginning with recollections from survivors of the Nakba, survivors of 1948, who actually relate their story to me of what happened to them in 1948, what happened to their particular village, and also similar stories about 1967, about what happened in 1967. And then it kind of comes straight up to date to relate stories of everyday life today in and around the refugee camps of the occupied West Bank. So it's important really just to get these stories out. It's important that people start to listen and to understand the Palestinian perspective, which is very much the reality of what's happening on a daily life. Ida refugee camp itself is a tiny, tiny little area that measures probably around 100 metres by 80 metres. And inside that area live 5,000 people literally living on top of each other. Mm. With tiny little streets that you often can't fit cars down. We have schools. We have two schools inside the camp. One of the schools has been attacked by the Israeli army and had to be almost entirely rebuilt, despite the fact it's a United Nations school. It's clearly marked as a school. It was full of children when it was attacked by the Israeli army, much as we saw with schools in Gaza last year that were attacked by the Israeli army. So nowhere is sacred. The mosque inside the camp is full of bullet holes. The schools inside the camp are full of bullet holes. Every house inside the camp is full of bullet holes. And this is the daily life for people inside the camp. It's this life of living under this really fierce military occupation. And, of course, living in the bigger picture, which is under this system of continued colonisation and apartheid that Israel continues to develop at pace while the world remains silent, if not supports it in many cases.
Rich, it has to be emphasized that we're talking about a civilian community, not a military community, and Israeli military forces, the IDF, they attack civilians, including children. I mean, if a child throws a stone, a rock or something, a stone, something you can hold in your hand and throw, and I've written about this a number of times, a young Israeli soldier, basically a young kid, has freedom to shoot them dead, and nothing will happen to them.
Of course, that's a very valid point, but to understand that, it's also worth noting that so many people have been... We've had, I think, 27 people killed inside the camp during this intifada alone. Dozens, hundreds probably, that have been injured by shooting. And as you say, this includes children. We've had one child that was killed whilst he was playing football as the apartheid wall was being built around the camp. Apparently he was playing football in the wrong area, and he was shot and he was killed. And his friend Saddam had a bullet that went straight through his leg, so one of the children ended up being shot in the leg, and the other child was killed. And these were children that were playing football. So we shouldn't be led to believe that only people that are throwing stones or involved in some kind of actions are the people that are getting injured. This happens to anybody. This happens to children playing football. We had a child in 2006, in December 2006, that was actually shot whilst he was inside his own bedroom in Ida Camp. And he was one of the youngest, one of the young artists that I'd been working with in the previous year. And he was playing on his balcony of his bedroom, or his sister's bedroom, at 12 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, when the Israeli army opened fire on a group of children in the bedroom and on the balcony of their bedroom. And Miraf was shot straight through the stomach with a 250mm bullet from an M16. So this is very important to understand, that these attacks on the camp, these shootings at the camp, these children getting shot, these are not children that are necessarily getting shot because they're throwing stones. These are children that have been shot whilst they're playing football. These are children that have been shot whilst playing inside their own houses. So this is the real extent that it's going to. It's not just people who are involved in resistance that are getting shot. It's anybody. Anybody living inside Ida Camp is liable to being shot at any time, basically.
We're talking about cold-blooded murder. Also, farmers in their fields are shot in cold blood. Fishermen off Gaza fishing, Israeli boats attack them, kill fishermen, ram their boats, destroy them. But they're not bothering anybody. They're just fishing. Farmers are just tilling their fields, and they're shot dead. And women as well, women out in the fields with their husbands. I mean, just shot dead. This is the worst kind of viciousness. And who says anything? This is what bothers me the most. The world community just looks away and says and does absolutely nothing. Criticizing Israel, especially in America, Rich, is absolutely verboten, except in the alternative media on a program like this. It's impossible on the corporate media here in this country to hear one bad word said about Israel. It just doesn't happen. And if any on-air person tried to do it, they would instantly be yanked off the air, fired. So they don't do it.
It's become very much a taboo subject. Every time there's any kind of criticism of the acts of the state of Israel, of the Israeli military, the Israeli propaganda machine tries to dress this up as some kind of anti-Semitism, which it clearly isn't. This is nothing to do with religion. This is about human rights. This is about a child being shot whilst he's playing football, or a fisherman being shot, or a farmer being shot. The examples that you've just given, this is very much a human rights issue. This is nothing to do with religion. But these are human rights issues. These are issues that should never be happening in this day and age. Yet, as you say, the world not only turns its back, but to be quite clear about this, the world is actually funding. If we look at, you know, the money that was used to pay for the apartheid wall, the money that's used to build settlements, the military, the actual weapons that Israel's getting, where are these weapons coming from? These are being funded by dollars or by euros. This is actually being supported by many regimes, by many governments around the world. So it's not just the fact that people are silent to this, it's the fact that people are actually, in many ways, supporting this and propagating this by the arms trades with Israel, by military aid to Israel, such as the New Deal that George Bush signed slightly before he retired.
Well, very definitely, Rich. America especially, we give Israel billions of dollars every year, the latest weapons and technology. I've said openly, if people want to know what the real axis of evil is in the world, there's one other country too, very sadly, the one that where you're residing right now, put together America number one, Israel and the UK. It's really a horrific story. But it goes way beyond that. The entire Western community is at least looks askance and doesn't do a thing. And international law says that not reacting to crimes of war and against humanity makes those nations complicit in those crimes, but it still goes on. And the worst of all is the Arab community doesn't do a thing either.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's frustrating, the actions of the Arab community, but this is a human issue. This is a human rights issue. This is about humanity. And as you say, people that are aware of what's happening and not acting, these people are complicit. These people are effectively sanctioning the actions of the state of Israel. They're sanctioning the actions of the occupation, of the colonization, of the stealing of people's lands, of the forcing of refugees to stay as refugees for through lifetimes for many people. And this is something that really needs to change, and needs to change very quickly. But I think we're all aware of the fact that maybe I'm very cynical, but I don't expect that tomorrow Obama or Gordon Brown are going to stand up and to make a really strong statement to try and change things. So I believe this is very much down to us as people, as civilians of the world, to get involved in this kind of situation and to act in whatever way we can, whether this is through demonstrations or things like the boycott campaign, which particularly in Europe is really taking hold and being very starting to build in a successful way now. I know it's a more difficult issue in the States, but in Europe, the BDS campaign, the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions campaign, is really starting to have some kind of effect and is really becoming powerful now. And it's down to these kind of initiatives that originate from within Palestine, because the call for BDS actually came from Palestinian civil society. And that's a very important aspect of it, is that it's something the Palestinians have called for. And these kind of issues must be supported by other human beings, by other civilians around the world, to try and work for justice, because none of us expect that the powers that be, whether it be the United States or the UK or the leading powers, are going to get a conscience overnight, basically. So it's down for people to get involved. It's down for people to act in whatever way they can to get involved in the struggle for justice in Palestine.
Which I say it all the time, it absolutely never, 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 in capital letters, comes from the top down on all the big issues. If the people don't do it for themselves, it'll never get done, because those people on the top, they will keep pursuing the their oppressive, their imperial policies. Their goal is to aid themselves, which means basically taking something from somebody else. Doesn't have to be that way, but that's the way they operate. It's no different. Country after country after country, it's up to the people to react and to accomplish the kind of change that we want to see ourselves. Palestinians, my goodness, they're under occupation. They struggle every day for this, but they need help. They need help from us. And the same goes for so many other oppressed people around the world. People of Haiti upsets me right now. Haiti is an occupied country. Things are happening faster there. It's a brutal situation in Haiti, but Palestine. These are the kind of things that will always be my focus, Rich, to bring them to people's attention, because maybe what's happening in Haiti and Palestine today could happen to anybody at some other point the way we are going. We really are, in America, Rich, we are seeing our civil liberties literally being dismantled slowly below the radar, but they're being lost, and one day people will wake up and realize that the police state I know we're now living in America, the mask will be off, there'll be no more smiles, and the harshness will set in, and it will be a very ugly place. It's an ugly place right now, but once the mask comes off, anything goes, and I expect it to really get ugly. I hope I don't live long enough to see it. I'm in my mid-70s, but it really terrifies me. It will be like what Palestinians live under every day.
I certainly agree with you that it's down for people. You know, in the same way that we saw change in South Africa eventually against the South African apartheid regime, and that didn't come because the government stood up and got a conscience. That came because people all around the world started to work and started to work and started to work and built momentum and built momentum. And eventually people can start to work. When there's enough people working together, they can eventually start to really create change. And we need to do this. You know, this is so long overdue now. This is more than 60 years overdue. And it's down to people really now to get involved and to start really working in whatever way they can to change things in Palestine, because nothing is going to come from the top. And in the way that, you know, the boycott campaign was used against South Africa and eventually crept up to much higher levels and eventually brought about change very quickly when it finally happened, in much the way that, you know, the Berlin Wall came down almost overnight, the apartheid regime finished almost overnight once the change actually started to happen. And I believe the same thing will happen in Palestine. Anyone that sees Palestine, anyone that's aware of what's happening, knows that this is very, very clearly wrong. This is inhuman, what's happening in Palestine. And Palestinians just want justice. They want to live with equal rights, with human rights, like any people in the world, so they can go to, they can take the children to school, they can raise the family, they can work in their lands, they can move about with freedom. These are basic things that people all around the world are entitled to and need to have a quality of life as a human being. And this is all that Palestinians are struggling for. And we, as human beings, as citizens of the world, we need to join that struggle. Every one of us needs to join that struggle and get involved in some way and work to support Palestine.
Without question, Rich, we're getting near the end of our time. Rich's book, again, is called Behind the Wall, Life, Love, and Struggle in Palestine. Oh, it's a story I think I know about as well as I can without having been there, Rich. But it really is a horrific story. Maybe one day I'll get a chance to go and see it for myself. And we haven't even discussed Gaza under siege. As bad as it is in the West Bank, it's a lot worse in Gaza, as you know. Rich, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much. I'll use the last segment to make an announcement that I need to do. It's been a wonderful, wonderful session with you, Rich. It's an important story, and I thank you very kindly for coming on.
Thank you much. Thank you so much, Steve. It's been a real pleasure to be on. And please, to all of your listeners, get involved, work for some way for Palestine, and get involved.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
I want to use this last segment. I'll try to remember to do it again on Friday. I need to announce a change beginning next week. Actually, beginning this weekend, I will be moving over to the Progressive Radio News Hour, no longer broadcasting on Republic. It's been wonderful 2 years with John Stadtmiller. I greatly appreciate his support. It's been a wonderful relationship. It's been an honor for me to be able to do this here. Progressive Radio now picks up this Republic program on a one-day delay. They pick up the program from the archive, and they air it on a one-day delay. I have a Thursday program now on PRN, and beginning this, it's also at the same time, which is the reason that I run archives on the Thursday program tomorrow. On beginning this Saturday and Sunday, I'll be on the Progressive Radio Network live. It'll be 2 hours later. It'll be noon Central Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific Time, and varying times around the world wherever people tune in to listen, but all the programs will be archived like the Republic ones. You'll be able to go to them, either listen live or go to the archives and listen anytime, which is the way I do the listening that I'm able to do. I can't listen and write at the same time. I need to focus on my writing, and I do an awful lot of it, but I do listen to important things, not the garbage on the corporate media that you know about. What a waste of time. Except I need to monitor a little bit, mostly on mute, just to see where they're going, because I do media critiques. Check out the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, papers like that, to quote them, hang them on their own petard. They make it so easy for me to do, so I do some of that often. Usually it's part of another article. But I do my listening when I'm eating or when I'm doing some household chores. And it's wonderful to be able to have archives you can go to and listen when you're able to do it. Not everybody can't tune in the same time every single day and listen to a program. We do other things, some of which we have to do. We have appointments or whatever. But I want you to know that beginning this weekend, I'll be on Progressive. Progressive is really a wonderful operation, nonprofit. It's a different operation than Republic, just a small group of very dedicated people wanting to get out real information to people the way Republic does it. Republic is a profit-making operation. Progressive is not. They love my program. Why else would they pick it up? They came to me and said that they really would want to hear it. And then they wanted me to come on with them live. So it'll be a pleasure to be with them. I will miss Republic. I wish I could still be here. This week I have seven programs. My goodness, every day of the week I have a live program. That is a big a mouthful to chew up and swallow. I don't know if I'd want to do seven programs every week, but I will tell you that if I really needed to do it, I would do seven programs a week. I would do 10 programs a week. It's important to get out vital information. You know that. It's the reason you listen to this program. You can keep listening to it. You just have to do it in a different place. Google the Progressive Radio Network. You'll go right to the site. You'll see me up on it now. They are running promos and other programs about my program, so you'll be able to get it very easily. I'll mention it again on Friday, and I hope you'll keep listening to this program, because I'm honestly dedicated to bringing top guests discussing the most important issues, above all telling the truth. And what makes the program is not me, it's the people I bring on and the topics we discuss, like Rich Wiles today. Stick with us.